John and I both made this point that both of us are about 6 foot six and we have to kind of wriggle behind this microphone like a piece of human origami.
Okay. Thank you for that first on Woody Allen, Tom. That's that really is a first. There's another great Woody Allen quote about I only felt better when I gave up hope, which I try to say to liberally minded audiences when they collectively wring their hands that political action doesn't work.
Okay. I think we know from John's own career that political action is very important and a vital part of sustaining democracy. Anyway, let's start. John is in the process of making a new documentary about the role of propaganda in our society. John's been studying and researching this field for a number of years now and has lighted upon the work of people such as Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, on public relations and the role that public relations, government and corporate has played in shaping public opinion in Western societies about important topical issues. So my first question to John really would be to ask him to explore with us here today the role of propaganda, the role of public relations in shaping and manipulating and moulding public opinion around such important questions as the war on terror, President Obama, and indeed matters here closer to home, such as the position of the Aborigines in Australian society, about which, of course, many of us will have seen his documentaries. So, John, perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about the role of propaganda in moulding public opinion.
Well, I think, as ever, we can start with George Orwell when he said telling the truth is a revolutionary act. And that, of course, applies today more than ever. Now, those who set out to attempt to manage our thoughts, to manage our societies, to control us, were very much aware that truth was bound up with revolution. And you mentioned Edward Bernays. It's very interesting about Edward Bernays. We're talking about the early part of the 20th century. As you mentioned, he was a nephew of Sigmund Freud. So all those, that early Freudian philosophy and view of life was very vibrant. It was at the beginning of it at the time. And Bernays was an extremely right-wing individual. He had very sinister connections, I think, and very direct connections with the US establishment at the time, and also with multinational corporations. He was employed by the US tobacco industry, for instance, and he is credited with, and I think probably rightly, in getting millions of women to smoke. In that part, at that time, women didn't smoke as much as men. It was considered unladylike coming out of Victorian times. If they did it, they did it quietly, but men were the dominant smokers. And he promoted smoking as an act of feminist liberation, and he called cigarettes torches of freedom. Now, it sounds amazing, but look, I grew up in Australia with a brand of cigarettes called Peter Stuyvesant, which was called the International Passport to Smoking Pleasure, and they always had some extremely attractive young woman with a very long cigarette doing this on it. Now, that, I did smoke for a few years, whether that influenced me directly or not, but it does show. This was public relations. Now, it was Bernays who invented the term public relations because he said that the Germans during the First World War had given propaganda a bad name. So it was from there on to be public relations. This is terribly important we understand what Bernays himself called an invisible government because we have invisible governments now in various form of medias. And historically, that's always been the case. I mean, going back 400, 500, 600 years, the church was the mass media of its time. People to be informed, to find out what the line was, what they should say, and so on. The church was the the source of information in Western societies. It also played in other societies as well, of course, where the various religious institutions were, in effect, the mass media. That's why Henry VIII effectively nationalized the Church of England, because he wanted to control it. It's why the Tories in Britain in the last century nationalized the BBC. They wanted to control it. I'm not sure about the ABC, but the ABC was really a copy of the BBC in many ways, and there's that element about it. So that controlling information, that creation of an invisible government, has always been absolutely critical. And, you know, so that we have, you know, we have that very much today, but not in the same monolithic sense. It seems monolithic, but we have the internet, which of course the powers that control the general mass media are now moving to try and control the internet. Now, what's the reason for all this? Well, the reason number one is to pacify us, and the reason hasn't changed in 500 years. It's to bring us towards a certain view that we don't challenge the ruling ideology. In fact, today, the purpose is for us not to recognize the ideology. Now, that has been true in the United States for a very long time, where you have the dominant ideology is Americanism, which is the only ideology in the world that doesn't recognize itself as an ideology. But it is. And it's a very powerful ideology. Now, we have other ideologies, and we have offshoots of them. The one that we've been talking about, everyone has been discussing at this conference, of course, is capitalism. But I think we have to go beyond capitalism, which can almost seem like a bad abstract term. It isn't bad. It isn't abstract, of course, because it imposes on our lives. But I think we have to analyze it a lot more and understand, for instance, where the Labour Party, the role that the Labour Party plays in this, the role that liberal politics play in this, the role that all those distracting offshoots of the main ideology play in this. That seems to me terribly important, and I sometimes think on the left there's rather too much of simply railing at the social democracies and the Labour Party for having, quote, betrayed, instead of understanding that there's almost an historical convergence that has happened, long happened, now between all the parliamentary parties. And you know, the belief in Rudd is as naive as a belief in Abbott. That in recognizing that there is no difference, or if there is a difference, they're not significant differences. They're certainly not differences, for example, in what's called foreign policy. And again, one of the purposes of propaganda is a form of Holocaust denial. It has always been striking. It's been striking to me to come back to Australia in the last 15, 16 years, during which Iraq has been subjected to a kind of medieval siege, an embargo, with the sort of nice soft term of sanctions, and that you open the papers and you read that the Australian Royal Australian Navy is very proud of playing a role in policing these sanctions. Now, in fact, over the last 16, 17 years, the result of that embargo has meant the deaths of at least 2.5 million people. 1 million since 2003. I mean, all the studies, the peer-reviewed studies, published in The Lancet, done by John Hopkins University. You know, there's a variation in them. Before that, UNICEF put down the figure of 500,000 infants under the age of 5 in 1998 who died as a direct result of the sanctions imposed by governments such as this government, the government at the time. Now, that's a Holocaust. Yes, there was the Holocaust, and that is probably the most devastating event of the 20th century. But there are other Holocausts. And our denial of them, our ignorance of them, comes from a propaganda that, as I said at the beginning, sets out to pacify us, and perhaps does in some way. So that's, I suppose, as a journalist and a filmmaker, I've come to this myself over many years. It wasn't some great revelation that happened, and forth I went. It was really through experience and dealing with the mainstream media, working for the mainstream media, and understanding the incredible impact of censorship by omission, leaving out. That's the main censorship. And you get it, it's right across the spectrum in our media, from the ABC to the Herald Sun. There's no difference. There's a consensual agreement between them. Well, it's not a conspiratorial agreement, but it's in effect an agreement between them. So that's something that I feel that we should be aware of before we set down the road of understanding. Well, it allows us to understand, for instance, the Middle East. Once we understand propaganda, I think we understand the Middle East. We understand other parts of the world. We understand when we're being conned, when we pick up newspapers that Obama has brought in these historic healthcare measures. They're not. They're not historic. What they've done is affirmed that you don't get healthcare unless someone makes a hell of a lot of money. The whole thing is an illusion. And it's understanding those illusions that I think we need to do first before we can understand the many issues that we should.
Thanks, John. Yes, you talked about the role of invisible government and censorship by omission. Mm. Can you think of any particular examples that strike you? You mentioned the Middle East there. I guess both of us probably were of the age where Israel was the only democracy in the Middle East, where Palestinians were all terrorists. Perhaps you can expand a little bit more about this issue about censorship by omission, about how people's attitudes towards questions of Israel and Palestine have been shaped by official propaganda, broadcasting, the CNNs, the Sky TVs, and so forth.
Well, absolutely. Language, it's not only omission, but language vocabulary plays a terribly important role because these become the buzzwords. They become part of what's called the national conversation or any conversation. So the word terrorism, which is okay. There is something called terrorism. We saw the horrific results of it in Moscow and in the Caucasus this week. But that kind of terrorism is the terrorism of the weak against the strong, and you don't have to be necessarily on the side of the Chechens against the Russian state and so on, but it is the weak against the strong. The terrorism of the strong against the weak is overwhelmingly the prime terrorism, the terrorism that I described in Iraq, the terrorism in Gaza at the moment. This morning, turn on the radio, we find that Israel has attacked with its F-16s, attacked Gaza. What is it attacking? The majority of the population in Gaza are children. The government in Gaza is fully elected. This is a devastated society. It is as if we're all sitting round accepting the fact that the Warsaw Ghetto is going on and we're not doing anything about it. In fact, that did happen. But things were done about it. That's what this is. So it's that kind of understanding of vocabulary. When we talk about, for instance, the international community, which is a buzzword in the media, it means the United States, with a few little vassal helpers. Britain is the main one. Australia is a minor one, a very minor one. So minor that, when the US president wants to sort of feel that there is a place in the world that is the perfect place for him, he'll come down here unless he has better things to do. And that's what happened recently, of course. Other words in propaganda, the names of countries become propaganda. Iran is a propaganda term these days. You mention the word Iran, and it immediately conjures up the mad mullahs who are about to launch nuclear weapons on the rest of the Middle East. They don't have any nuclear weapons. That's beside the point. They don't like their system of government at all. It's pretty wretched, actually. But the level of insanity there is certainly no greater than in the White House, certainly no greater than in Tel Aviv or anywhere else. But that, in building us towards accepting, pacifying us towards accepting that war, we have the term of... And we could go on. Reform doesn't mean reform. It means actually the opposite of reform, turning things around so they're not reform. Democracy is probably the most abused term of all because it doesn't mean there are three pillars to democracy, and that is social change and economic change, social justice, economic justice, and electoral justice. Well, we have a sort of electoral justice, sort of. Not really, because it's all jerried up anyway. So democracy is a term. So propaganda plays through all of these. And in understanding, as you mentioned, Tom, the Israel-Palestine conflict, it's the propaganda tries to ensure that there are two kinds of victims, if you like. There are worthy victims, the Israelis, and there are unworthy victims, the Palestinians. So between 2000 and 2008, 5,000 Palestinians, a great many of them children, were killed by the Israelis. In that time, several hundred Israelis, yes, civilians, But a number of them, Israeli soldiers, also died. The disparity between the oppressor and the victim in terms of the carnage is so extraordinary that the propaganda has to make the oppressor the victim and the oppressed the oppressor. I mean, it is truly Orwellian because it just simply turns it around. There was a very good survey done by the University of Glasgow, which runs a pioneering media unit, and it produced this report done over many years called Bad News from Israel, and it studied the reporting in Britain of Israel-Palestine. And it found among most young viewers of television news thought that the illegal settlements in the West Bank were Palestinian, so that they were settling illegally in their own country. I mean, when I read that, I thought that is really an extraordinary condemnation of so-called mainstream journalism. And we're talking about the BBC here, which has enormous pretensions about itself, objectivity and impartiality and all that nonsense. That was the result of it. So I suppose it all comes down to information. The good news in all of this is, in my experience, in all societies, open societies as this is, there is a critical public intelligence that finds out almost by word of mouth. Word of mouth could be the internet. Word of mouth could be its own common sense. But you will find that most in the Western societies that I'm familiar with, this one, the United Kingdom, the United States, and elsewhere in Europe, that the that most people are, let's put it this way, well to the left of their governments. Now, you hear in Australia so often that from well-meaning people that the public at large are just damn stupid or apathetic and they're only interested in the footy and so on. Yeah, quite a few are actually, but quite a few are not. And that's true of the United States. Noam Chomsky for years has produced the evidence of polling from credible organizations like the Pew Organization and Gallup that shows the United States, the population of the United States, well to the left. It's almost as if the propaganda has another purpose, and that is to disguise the fact that there is a war in all these countries, and that's the war of the population versus the elite. The idea that the elite represents us is not true. That on one side there is the population, most of it, or many of it, but a good slice of it, substantial amount, a substantial number of people who are on the other side, and the elite is on that side. So you have, for example, in the United States, this Obama thing about healthcare. Time and time again, the overwhelming surveys in the United States showed that most people wanted universal coverage with what they call single payer, that is the government being the main player guaranteeing universal health coverage. The elite, i.e. Obama and his White House, basically got rid of that so that the debate became between Obama's anemic version of healthcare, which doesn't really add up to much at all, few improvements here and there, and it won't start for another 6 years or something, and the lunatic fringe known as the Tea Party. And those were the boundaries of the debate. Whereas the public on this critical issue, what they wanted, were left out completely. And yet the television screens were filled with the lunatics calling Obama a socialist and various racist things about him. So it's two communities, the invisible government at work.
Thank you. Yes. Speaking about words which take on a meaning quite opposite to what they really are, you mentioned settlements there. Like this idea of Israeli settlers. Who can be against settlers? They're settling land, aren't they? But you actually look at the role of the Israeli settlers, which is the advance guard of the Israeli Defense Force. Another word, I think, which has sort of entered our language as being seeming quite innocent, but in fact takes on quite a deadly meaning.
Well, it's like the Australian Defense Force. You tell that to the children that the SAS killed in Afghanistan recently. One of the rare excellent reports done by a SBS reporter called Sophie McNeil. You may have seen it on Dateline. They call themselves the ADF. They're not the ADF. They're an aggressive force that are sent off politically cautiously, because the government doesn't want too many of them to get killed and embarrass everybody. They're sent off to go to take aggressive roles in Iraq, Afghanistan, and wherever else the United States wants them to be.
Yes, one article you've written recently for the New Statesman, I think was quite thought-provoking, is talking about the way in which public opinion is shaped and moulded, and how things that are actually quite evil are sort of sanitised and made to appear normal. You wrote a column about the Oscars and the Hurt Locker phenomenon, Avatar and so forth. I wonder if perhaps you'd like to expand a little bit more about the role of Hollywood and the Hollywood industry in normalizing situations for the American public.
Yeah. Well, Anne and I have a habit of walking out of movies. It's something I started as a revolutionary act some years ago, my son is absolutely perplexed by this. He'll sit through some of the more crappy movies of all time. But Hollywood, of course, plays a very, very significant role in this. And here we've had this year the piece you're referring to I wrote before the Oscars, but it all came true. There was The Hurt Locker, which was basically about yet another American psychopath blowing up things in somebody else's country. Finish. And the director went round saying it's neutral, no politics and everything. How did he get there? Who knows? What was the effect on the society? Who knows? Nothing to do with me. It's non-political and so on and so forth. Classic Hollywood war movie. Hollywood has played this role. I mean, another current one which upset me, and I wonder if Trevor Nagwani has seen it, called Invictus, with Clint Eastwood directing it. Just an insult, a profane insult to the struggle against apartheid, that he narrowed it all down to the Springboks rugby team being anointed as all right by Nelson Mandela. As Trevor pointed out last night in his presentation, there were many in the struggle who actually were way ahead of Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela played a very important role, but there were many angry with his patronage of the Springbok football team. Anyway, these are all historical truths. What Hollywood does, and what propaganda of the kind that we've been discussing here today does, is reinforce amnesia. It's a kind of organized forgetting, a dereliction of memory. And that dereliction of memory is the worst thing that can happen to us. Because unless we remember, we don't have to go back to Henry VIII, although I think that's quite interesting that he wanted to control the mass media of the time, a bit like Rupert Murdoch today. it's a slightly bizarre comparison, but never mind, it'll do. that dereliction of memory is such an important concept to understand. The struggle against memory is the struggle against forgetting, which Kundera said, something that I keep saying almost as a mantra, because it is so true. We have to have everything we see today politically and try and understand has to be contextualized. No struggle can happen unless it has an historical context. And Hollywood plays a very, very potent role. I mean, when being a filmmaker, there's nothing like sitting in a darkened cinema and seeing your own film up on a big screen. It's mystical almost. How did it happen, and so on. And when we go in and, as we're invited to, and rightly, suspend all the problems that we can perhaps leave at the box office and so on and see something, we also become subjected to a kind of propaganda that, in terms of wars, the Iraq War is now being promoted by Hollywood as the Vietnam War was 10 years after it finished. And that is a kind of a noble cause in which mistakes were made, but we can now purge ourselves of all the mistakes, the errors. Meanwhile, the Afghan war is really a good war. The whole thing is just absolute nonsense. None of it is true. A general the other day, American general the other day, called the Afghan war a war of perception. It was, you get these wonderful flashes of honesty, out they pop. And he said the most important thing was not the actual war of people killing each other, in fact, them killing civilians or trying to give us the impression that the Pashtun people and various other people are all Taliban, so they can all be grouped under this awful demonized name. No, the idea was that what is important is the media, the way that war is presented as the media. So we had recently a big set-piece battle, so-called. They love set-piece battles because they're like Hollywood. And this one was against a city. It was called the battle, called Marja. Operation...
The town's Marja.
The town's Marja, yeah. In fact, they called it a city in the United States. It wasn't a city. It was a group of very impoverished compounds, villages and so on. And it was meant to be a Taliban command and control center. There was no command and control center. So the idea that this extraordinary siege was about to begin against this massive, all these battlements armed by Taliban was projected, that's the war of perception. None of it was true. It was pure Hollywood. So you get Hollywood transferring to the actual war itself, where generals and spinners and latter-day Edward Bernayses consider the Hollywood factor as they propagate the war.
If I could maybe turn our attention a little bit now to Australia. We've already touched on it a couple of times. You mentioned the Labor government and so forth. People may remember that when Rudd's apology to the Stolen Generation came out in February 2008, opinion was fairly mixed on the issue. Obviously, a lot of Indigenous people welcomed the step that the government had taken. John was a little more critical at the time, and I think has perhaps feels justified in his criticism of the Rudd government and its record in Aboriginal rights in terms of maintaining the Northern Territory intervention. John obviously has made a series of documentaries in the 1980s, around the time of the Bicentennial and so forth, the Commonwealth Games in Brisbane, around the plight of Indigenous people. And one of the shots he shows frequently in his documentaries is one of the anecdotes he speaks about quite regularly is breaking in a gate with Charlie Perkins in about 1969 to actually reveal conditions in Australia's own genocidal war against Aborigines, having taken place over the previous 180 years. I wonder if John would like to expand a little bit more about how he sees Northern Territory intervention fitting into that historical record of genocide and expropriation of the Aboriginal people.
Well, I mean, when the apology was made by Rudd, the Sydney Morning Herald had an excellent editorial, excellent in that they told the truth inadvertently. And it described them, it said, the Rudd government has moved quickly to clear away this piece of political wreckage in a way that responds to some of its own supporters' emotional needs, yet it changes nothing. It's a shrewd maneuver, unquote. That's it. And that's been shown to be that. I went to a very important meeting in Sydney on Monday, at which the former judge, Alistair Nicholson, QC, former head of the family court, spoke. And he has spoken out against the Rudd government's, as he calls it, sham measures in which it says it's repealing the Race Discrimination Act. It isn't. And what it's done is brought in what it calls special measures. So, in fact, without going into it in detail, but what it adds up to is that the intervention, all the draconian aspects of the intervention have actually become more entrenched under the Rudd government and extended, so that we now have the Alua people being some of them, those that haven't courageously walked off, and other Aboriginal groups, now having to trade their right to the land rights that were almost inadvertently given to them by the Fraser government in Northern Territory, having to trade those rights, trade their right to public housing, trade their right to welfare in when they're in dire circumstances, trade all of that in order to get basic housing, for example. I mean, what followed Tom the Rudd's apology was a clear promise to implement a program called Closing the Gap. And this was mainly based on housing. And in the years since then, what we've had is 3 houses built. However, 56 houses have been built for government business managers who earn up to $200,000 a year. So the administration, in fact, of what's known as welfare quarantining, which basically is stealing half your welfare income, giving you a card, you turn up at Coles, you're told to stand in a special queue, you're humiliated, and if it doesn't work, if you haven't got enough on your card, it's a bit like trying to make a phone call in Senegal or somewhere, you know, on a card, when your money runs out, that's the end of it. And the same thing happens in Coles and in various Northern Territory communities. The cost of administering that welfare denial program is $351 million. Now, some years ago, the Sydney Morning Herald's Honourable Exceptions, a reporter called Deborah Jobson, and another reporter, I'm sorry, I've forgotten his name, produced a very fine piece of investigative journalism in which they found that something like $6 billion had gone over the years ostensibly to Aboriginal people, to infrastructure and to welfare and to development and so on and so forth. Most of it had gone to white schemes. So the whole thing was, in the broad sense, corrupt. And I did an interview on the ABC not all that long ago, in which the interviewer said, in fact, it was said to me twice in a week, wasn't the ABC twice, but it's interesting. What do you say to those who say we're just throwing money at the Indigenous thing? We're throwing money at it. This is, you know, it's like international community and terrorism and all the other ones. There's no one throwing money at it. Well, the money is being thrown the other way, actually. It's being thrown to government business managers who get $200,000 a year sitting in their house, like the very people that Charlie Perkins and his mother Hetty and I encountered when we rammed an old Ford Falcon through the gates of the big Commonwealth. It wasn't called a reservation, it was called something else at the time. But yes, there have been changes since then, of course there have, and no one has been denying it. But that there has not been the change in terms of attitude. At best, it's paternalism. At worst, it's an authoritarianism. And that's how, and when we understand that authoritarianism, we start to understand what these Labour governments, Rudd, Blair, throw in the Democrats, I suppose, in the US, and a few others, what they really are. Because what this intervention by the Rudd government means, and it's theirs now, very much, invasion, I would call it, invasion and occupation, and exploitation. It's all about, it has to be all about clawing back the Northern Territory, which, as I mentioned, Malcolm Fraser granted land rights to following the Woodward report that Whitlam set up. Whitlam wanted land rights to all of Australia. Fraser at least gave it to the Northern Territory. And every government since then, Hawke, Howard, Keating, the lot, have wanted to claw that back because of the minerals and the potential for making vast amounts of money from toxic waste storage in that part of the world. The main railway line that runs from the Olympic Dam uranium mine, the biggest in the world in South Australia, is built by Kellogg and Root. Dick Cheney had, Howard's old mate, he's had quite a lot to do with that. That runs right up through the Northern Territory. The infrastructure for massive minerals, toxic waste storage and the rest of it is there waiting to go. And the Aboriginal people are in the way. I'm not saying that's the only reason. I think bashing the Aboriginal people has been almost a sport for the Australian elite since it arrived in this country. But that's the reason. What's interesting about the Rudd's application of it, though, is that this, as Judge Nicholson explained it the other night, the 50% theft, the theft of 50% of Aboriginal welfare, in order to make it seem non-discriminatory, is going to be applied right across the board. So as he pointed out, you have one of the most extraordinary pieces of social engineering in modern Australian history being carried out without any public discussion. And that, as someone on the panel there described it, it'll soon be coming to a suburb near you because it is a way of controlling welfare right across this country. So it doesn't seem like it's discriminating. Of course, the main reason of it, at least the primary reason of it, is to control the Aboriginal people. But it has a much wider application than that. So these things are happening under our nose. And they're happening under our nose. We should know about them. And we shouldn't be bluffed by the kind of propaganda that suggests that Mr. Rudd and Ms. Gillard are nice, cuddly social democrats. And you see their statements on Israel, particularly Gillard's. I think you can disabuse yourself of that.
Thank you, John. Yes, I was actually going to take you on to a little bit more about the Rudd government. Obviously, I'm guessing you're not a great fan of Kevin Rudd.
I've nothing against him personally.
Nothing against Percy, of course. No, no, no. John has written a lot about what he calls Brand Obama, and I think takes great issue with some writers who, for example, it's Paul Krugman, the well-known American liberal, referred to, said, Obama will restore America's image as a nation of moral ideals. I'm not sure if Paul Krugman would still say that. Maybe he might. But I wonder, given the fact that in the last 2.5 years, we've seen the end of both the Bush administration and also the Howard government, I imagine to the great relief of everyone in this room, and the replacement by Obama and by Rudd. I wonder whether perhaps you can just expand a little bit about what changes we've seen or what changes you might have expected to see, or in what sense do you feel like we've been let down by these change of administrations, that people's hopes for change is expressed most clearly with Obama, have actually led into something of a dead end.
I would contest a couple of words you used there. Let down. Why were you hoping? Why did you expect it? Tom, you're meant to be a revolutionary. Come on. Obama is possibly, those American friends and colleagues of mine who study him very closely, I would think is probably more dangerous than Bush was. Because a Bush was pretty easy to hate. We didn't think ever we'd be let down by him. Our expectation was down there. What Obama has done is, I believe, what he was enlisted to do. He's neutralized the left in the United States. The left, that part of the left, or the social democratic left, associated with the Democratic Party, including the entire black caucus in the United States, it's coming alive finally now, it's sort of rising from the dead, but it died on the night of hysterics when Obama was elected. Historic, yes. Yes. An African-American elected president in the land of slavery. But surely real historical significance only happens when they do something. Otherwise, we wouldn't remember these great people. We wouldn't remember those that history suggests to us have changed things. Obama has certainly changed things. He's compounded almost everything Bush has done. The healthcare thing is a sop. Yes, there are slight improvements, and I don't really want to go into those too much, but they're the sort of thing that any kind of civilized society, such as children no longer apparently are going to be denied insurance, healthcare insurance, if they have a pre-existing condition. I mean, it's just absolutely shocking that children were denied it in the first place. That's considered progress. Okay, let's put that aside. What he's done, he's extended all the abolition of habeas corpus, which effectively happened in the United States, the Bill of Rights. He said he'd close Guantanamo, which he hasn't. He's extended the Patriot Act, which allows the FBI to go into libraries and find out what you're reading. I wouldn't like to be caught up in the American court system these days. Let's say, quote, his own people, African-American people, have become more of a devastated undercaste in the United States than ever before. In the state of Georgia, which boasted about having a black ruling elite, there are more people incarcerated than in any other state. Not only that, that the ruling black elite are ensuring that most black people are kicked out of the center of Atlanta, as I found recently in San Francisco. That's what's happened there. The transfer of wealth from the bottom to the top by Obama is historic. The greatest military war budget of all time has been sent to Congress by Obama, $708 billion. Nothing ever like it. He has extended the wars into Pakistan. He's extended it into Somalia. He's extended the arming of something like 50, there are 54 countries in Africa. He's arming 50 of them. And we're all meant to go jelly at the knees over Obama. I'm sorry, but my patience absolutely disappears and will not return when people give me this stuff about Obama. You see, the whole in being intimidated by the fact that he is an African-American ignores completely the fact that all you people here should know that it's not the color of your skin that matters, it's the class you serve. And the class he serves is the same class that George W. Bush served, the same class that Clinton served, the same class that Reagan served. It's the same system. Obama, because he has this mask, if you like, if it still exists, has actually taken it further, in, as I've mentioned, but in, I mean, let's take the role of the Pentagon, the military establishment. Obama did as no other president in U.S. history has ever done. He transferred the complete Pentagon of his discredited predecessor, including the Secretary of State for Defense, Robert Gates, over to his patch. So the whole thing went on exactly as it has. And the, the role of the military in the United States has never been greater. Now, this is terribly important for us in Australia to understand because we're in the world, number one. We're in a world that is made a very dangerous world by big power, by great power. But our own so-called ADF is increasingly militarized and politicized. You see this in the papers that come out, those who are writing about them. Look at some of the literature around the great heroic Australian rescue of East Timor, which was none of those things, of course. And you'll see the real reason for it, and that is to establish a military presence in an Australian sphere of influence. So these are important things that we have to understand. Again, going back to Obama, Tom, I think if the best way is to look at the Bush administration's... Who are the people that Bush had round him that he really liked? Condoleezza Rice. She qualifies twice. She's black and she's a woman. She was one of the more dangerous human beings, I think, in my lifetime. Colin Powell, another one. The man who stood up at the United Nations in February 2003. And lied about weapons of mass destruction. Gonzalez, his attorney general, who used to sign off on the execution of people in Texas with George W. Bush when Bush was governor there, you know. And many others. It's again an illusion that may be difficult for some people to set aside because we're all pleased, I suppose, that in the land of slavery, a man of color can occupy that position. But if you go to South Africa, and as Trevor was mentioning last night very eloquently, as I have on a number of occasions, the black elite there have simply allied themselves with the old white elite. That again, what matters above all, is class.
Well put. Maybe come to my final question now, John, and we'll open up to the floor. So those who'd like to ask questions might want to start jotting it down on a sheet of paper, and I think we'll be setting a microphone up around about here. Final question I have is, and I'm just going to use Obama as a springboard here. One of the things, of course, he talked about was hope. Another picture with, you know, the very famous poster with Obama and hope written underneath. So we've heard a lot about the nefarious, dirty deeds of our establishment in America and Australia and Britain and elsewhere. I don't want to end on a kind of a flat note about, oh, my God, these people are bastards. They are, but let's not just finish it there. I'd like to ask, John, what gives you hope? You mentioned before the gulf between the elites and the rulers on the one hand and the masses on the other. Do you see, you know, the potential for that gulf to open up in politically positive and progressive ways?
But, Tom, Again, I just, in your question there, you talked about the dirty deeds of these people as if they're a bunch of personalities running around. We're talking about a system, and it doesn't matter who is there, and I don't really feel that they are necessarily themselves purveyors of dirty deeds. I'm sure they don't beat their partners and they pat their children on the head and they do all that. It's a system. What gives me hope is when I see mass movements changing that system. I don't like the word hope. I like the Woody Allen description of hope, that he felt much better when he gave it up. Because then I think I've taken on from Woody Allen, because then you can get down to actually doing things rather than sitting around hoping. And a lot of people in the world are doing things. This conference is about doing things, because information is our first power. Without it, we can't really move anywhere. I've spent some time in Latin America, and I find it thrilling. And that's why Obama has taken over 7 bases in Colombia in which to wage a war of attrition against the popular democracies in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in Paraguay. Paraguay, which used to be almost the caricature of where all the Nazis went and, you know, this disgusting military regime. It's not perfect. None of them are. But it's beginning to give back to the majority of the people of Latin America what has long been owed to them. I found in filming in Venezuela the spectacle, and I use that word advisedly, spectacle, of a 90-odd-year-old woman learning to read and write for the first time, and how thrilled she was. And that represented, in Venezuela, they now have 100% literacy. We don't hear of any of these advances. We don't hear that in Ecuador, that the only American base, apart from Colombia, on the continent, was thrown out of Ecuador by a very courageous government led by a man called Carreras. He put he's also got a great sense of humor, because he said, look, you can have your base in Ecuador if we can have a base in Miami. And out it went. But the most extraordinary thing that's happening is the coming together of countries in Latin America, a continent devastated by imperialism, first by the Spanish, then by the Europeanized immigration waves of the 19th century, devastated, and particularly by the United States, because it took the U.S., I think it was Teddy Roosevelt, who said that if we never control, and I paraphrase him, if we don't control Latin America, we'll never control the world. And the good news is, Tom, that they're no longer controlling Latin America. That people there, in Bolivia, you have the first indigenous government ever. And not only that, it survived. It survived the president. Evo Morales has survived a recall referendum and increased his power. And step by step, the kind of civilized society is being built upon the cultural civilizations that exist there. I find that fantastic news. I find the movements that, I find the fact that when Trevor mentioned last night that South Africa has the world record for protests, I think that's fantastic. My sense of it, perhaps I was a little more excited about it than he, but my sense of it is that there are real terrible problems in South Africa, but the political energy and debate and protest and dissent in that country is just, is forging ahead. In Greece, there is the first real, apart from the French earlier on, but a country, a small country of only 11 million people, is putting up, people in the streets are putting up a hell of a fight against the German and French central banks' blueprint for Europe, the neoliberal blueprint for a whole continent, and so on. You can cross the world to the Philippines, for example, where the mass movements haven't been able to shake the center, but they've been able to give people the very hope you've described. The same is true in the Indian subcontinent. I just think the popular movement, that which was described once as the other superpower, is certainly, yes, it's diffuse at the moment, but where it is most diffuse is in the countries where there is more freedom, like here. And that should be something that should give us something to reflect upon. We don't have yet, and I don't think we will, we do have the Australian Federal Police. So I forgot about them, the sort of Mac Senate of, but we don't yet have people kicking down the doors and pointing guns at us, unless we're Muslim people, of course. That can happen. But generally speaking, we have a great deal of freedom in this country, as they have in the United Kingdom, as they still have in the United States. And it's in those countries where we have the privilege of making change that the greatest work is to be done. Because, you know, again, quoting Chomsky, I think when he was asked, you know, what can we do? Lead us, you know. What can we do? Well, he says, well, look, I'm sorry, you go to a country like Turkey or somewhere, or where they're up against it, and they don't even have to ask that question because they know what to do. And I think the hope is in all those people around the world who are doing it. And I suggest we join them.
We now have time for about 20 minutes or so for questions, so how we're going to run this is if people would like to ask a question, just come to the microphone here in the middle of the hall. Corey here in the dark blue shirt will help organise this. We're going to have one question followed by an answer directly by John, then another question, and we'll keep going for 20 minutes or so until we run out of time. So who'd like to ask a question first? If you just make your way to the microphone and just form a queue, and then we can do sort of first come, best dressed. Realistically, probably only about four or five questions will get up, so the whole hall evacuates
like
to stand by the microphone.
Really?
Yes, okay. All right, now the true spirit of neoliberalism, we're now going to sell spots for access to the microphone. Just joking. Okay, first question, please.
Thanks for that. That was great. My question is sort of one of them is, in your writing, you sort of mentioned the fact that isn't it hard to break the military-industrial complex in America, the U.S. UN, and you said that the U.S. is trying to engage in a political war. So I just want to clarify what you mean by that. If the military-industrial complex is still very strong in the U.S. now, obviously, the political war the second part of the question is, what role do you think social entrepreneurs will play in society?
What role will...
The role of social entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
During my later years, he talked about the role of social entrepreneurs.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think it can be rolled into one answer. Yes, there is a state of permanent war. There's no question about that. And the wonderful thing about the Bush administration was that they were so honest. They said it. Cheney talked about an endless war, and many of them referred to a permanent war. All the documents they produced said as much. That doesn't mean to say that it's going to happen. It is happening at the moment. There is also an enormous fear in the centers of power about people. I mean, I've always felt that they see us in many ways the way we should see them. They see us as the real enemy in the centers of power. They don't see the Taliban and these sort of faraway tribesmen as enemies. Yes, they're sort of getting in the way, but they can, as they did in Iraq, they can arrive with cases of dollars and bribe everyone to bits and sort of have a temporary standoff. But they see us as the enemy. An enormous amount of resources is given to dealing with us, the enemy. In propaganda, bring it back to what we were talking about at the beginning, the Pentagon, for example, spends something like a third on directly and indirectly propaganda as it spends on actually fighting wars. The propaganda that is relayed through the media, you take the campaign against Iran in trying to set up Iran for an attack, is because they fear the kind of extraordinary public demonstration of decency that happened in February 2003 and happens all over the world. The fact that it's not reported doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It does happen. It happens in South Africa all the time. There are massive demonstrations. It can break out at any time in Europe. It is happening in Greece. All this is feared. And I think, going back really to my, I suppose, the last point I made, that's where both our hope lies and where their Achilles heel is. That, you know, Mao Zedong did often refer to paper tigers, and I thought it was quite an interesting expression, although I'm not sure I want to necessarily quote his movement, but the paper tiger, the United States and its network of allies, Great Britain, Australia, other countries, European Union, shaky group, is very powerful and capable of great damage. But it's also a paper tiger. And the fact that we've seen in my lifetime such extraordinary events that I'd never thought would happen, such as the end of the Stalinist Empire in Eastern Europe, the collapse of the Berlin Wall coming down, the end, official end anyway, if not the economic end of apartheid in South Africa, the liberation of Eritrea and so on, many others, against the wishes and the designs and the practices of great power like the United States, means that this change can happen again. And that's where the social movements, as you call them, will play a very, very vital, play a very vital role. The United States is a bankrupt country. Most of its currency is foreign currency, is owned by China. That doesn't mean to say, as some commentators are suggesting, that it's about to collapse. It isn't. Far from it. It's a very, very powerful entity. But it does fear what most of humanity thinks and does and opposes and tries to take action against it. Thus the invention of a war on terrorism. So the more we, that is, the rest of humanity do, the greater the hope for a peaceful world.
I'll take the next question now. Just to remind people, we're looking for questions here, not statements. So if you can keep them brief and not double or triple barrel, that'd be great. Thank you.
Language and social mobilization on the left. And I noticed that you use, maybe interchangeably, the term elite and the term ruling class. And in terms of the mobilization of peoples, well, firstly, both of those terms have different histories. Clearly, one is from a Weberian history, the other one is from a Marxist history. And I'm wondering why you use the term elite as opposed to ruling class, and what do you think, if any, are the different implications for mobilisation of people on the left?
Thank you.
You're saying I use the term ruling class, do you?
Well, you use the term elite most.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah. Okay, class. I try not to use the term ruling class, actually. And I try not to use what I would call embedded language, in order to reach out to a wider audience. The elite, I agree with you. If I could think of a better way of describing them, I probably would. I do agonize over actually using these terms so that they don't come over as almost sectarian terms, as hackneyed terms. I think elite will do at the moment, because the elite encompasses the political class and the business class. And they're the two pillars of, in any Western democracy, in any Western society, they're the pillars. There's a third pillar, of course, and that is the cultural class, which plays a very important role of silence, in that it rarely speaks about what the political class and the business class is doing, usually because it's bought off with various prizes and appointments and all the rest of it. So I think that's the elite. I'll have to go and consult the Rogers. I can't think of anything else at the moment. I can assure you it's plucked out of the back of my head from somewhere, and it doesn't have any double meaning to it. It's just trying to say those who try to run us control us, the bosses.
Thanks, John. Next question. You speak up just a fraction, yeah. Please.
You mentioned briefly the idea of walk-off and woman perish. And my question was regarding that, specifically framing historical context, specifically in pluralism as a society. After you spoke last year, I'm sure it was here, and the walk back in the most, we're not further pushing down to this is first person for the language, very nice to be in the room.
Yeah. Well, look, that's asking for a commentary on the Australian media from me. The journalists aren't there. There are several honourable exceptions, as I call them, and I mentioned one of them, Deborah Jobson, who did some very, very good work for the Sydney Morning Herald and presumably The Age. there is the people on the National Indigenous Times, but in this mainstream stroke corporate media, undoubtedly there are people from time to time who take their principles into the media and before they're beaten out of them manage to get something out. But I don't know where they are. I think if you look at the Murdoch press, is that actually a very sinister reporting of Indigenous affairs. The promotion of Noel Pearson, for example, the Murdoch press's favourite, has been unrelenting. The message is that, well, they really need us to deal with them in a paternalistic way. The clear message is to get them off the land that we want. And it's often presented in a sort of quasi-sympathetic way. I find the Australian almost fascinating, the way it does this. So they're not there. And if there are young journalists training in the audience or those who want to be journalists, and I've run into plenty of aspiring journalists in Australia who have all the good sense and good heart and principle to want to do that, all I can say is try and navigate your way through a system and do it. You know, you can pick up the left press from Socialist Alternative to Green Left Weekly and you'll get some good reporting, very good reporting. But I think they just aren't the journalists because the media in Australia is an extension and a very often very crude extension of the established order in this country.
I'd just maybe like to reinforce the point John made there about the role of the National Indigenous Times. The author, Chris Graham, who's the editor of the National Indigenous Times, has done a fantastic job in exposing the intervention. And I'd really strongly recommend that people look up the National Indigenous Times, look at Chris Graham's work, and find out what the intervention looks like from the ground. The next question.
Okay. I just wanted to ask you, so if you've been talking a lot about the nature of the Labor government at the moment, and the fact that the right government has disgustingly continued on with a lot of Howard's agenda, I think one of the most revolting aspects of this has been their maintenance of mandatory detention and actually escalating or expanding the detention centre on Christmas Island and modelling something similar to Guantanamo Bay, basically a psychological torture chamber. But what I actually wanted to ask you was that recently it's come to light that the Greens have put forward a policy that is to curb immigration, sort of under the screen of environmental strategies to combat environmental disaster, but I think that's a very racist trajectory, so I just wanted to know what your opinion on that was.
Well, you've answered it, really. I don't know about the Greens. I don't follow the Greens very much, I have to confess. And if that's what they put up, you described it accurately. That's racist.
Henry Reynolds and other historians have been arguing the case that the more cultural genocide occurring in the Australian history. Even in our own times, though, there's a cultural genocide in terms of the language extinction.
Well, yeah. I mean, let people speak their own languages and ensure that they are taught in their own languages. Use the intelligence and sophistication and resources in this country to support the first Australians in the way that they want to extend their own language, their own cultural uniqueness. You know, it comes down just to very crude resources. I saw another honourable exception was on the ABC not all that long ago, a report on two schools in the Northern Territory. One was an Aboriginal school and the other one was largely a white school. The resources that the white school had in developing language and developing IT skills and so on was 21st century. The Aboriginal school was, you know, kids still covered in dust, having travelled along unsurfaced roads, which ensures they get trachoma and all those things. These are basic. These are basic. I remember going, never forget, I went when I first went to the United States to live as a reporter, and I went up to Harlem. This was not long after Martin Luther King was assassinated, and it was pretty volatile then. And I said to a black community worker leader, what do we do? I mean, it seems to be, you know, such a complex problem. And, you know, and I rather overawed by what I was seeing. And he said, well, you start by tearing these slums down, putting in decent facilities, making sure the taps run with clean water, giving our kids the best education, blah, 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 first, and then we'll talk about all the complexity of it. And that's what happens, what should happen here. Only the Aboriginal people should be in charge of this. The lack of consultation, the arrogance of this authoritarian regime, elite, whatever you want to call it, in Australia, in the way it's exercised this intervention is like something out of the dim past. It's like out of the 20s, you know. That's really all I can answer to that, I think.
We have time for one more question.
My question was on the topic of Palestine. Because the film Palestine is still the issue is one of my favourite out of your work. And at the end of that film, I don't know if this quote you, but you talk something along the lines of those two-state solutions,
yeah,
in Palestine. And I was wondering if recent events since that film, you know, the expansion of facts on the ground in the West Bank, the settlements and the siege, what your opinion is now on the debate over one state or two-state solution for Palestine?
I think yes. I'm glad you've asked that. I don't see the one-state solution on paper is all very well, but that then puts the Palestinian people up against the kind of present-day enemies and obstacles that would dwarf their present predicament. I don't think I'd do that camera piece these days. And what I would say is, I suppose, it's almost a solution that has to come from outside, in that the United Nations General Assembly, now this is one area of that world body that has demonstrated year upon year its total support for justice in Palestine and for a Palestinian state. I think I'm not absolutely clear in my own mind about how this might go, but I would quite like to see a worldwide campaign directed at the UN so that the General Assembly, which it can do, declared a state of Palestine. So it's a fait accompli, in other words. This raises all sorts of problems and questions, I know. But so just as the PLO back in the 1970s got UN recognition, I think recognizing a state of Palestine based on international law, because international law dictated, back in 1948, before the Israelis and the Zionists grabbed land, began their massive land grabbing, which hasn't stopped, that they declared a state of Palestine based on that law. That would bring the kind of pressure on Israel, on the United States, on the backers, that once you had a reality in law, a reality in international discourse, if not in actuality, I think that might do it. Now, that's trying to think, as I've tried to think around this one state, two state thing, clearly they've wrecked, as they set out to do, any hope of a two-state two-state solution to that. At the moment, you know, it's just a series of cantonments, bantustans, whatever you want to call them, with the population utterly controlled. And if someone like Abbas or some other Vichy Palestinian managed to overrule the majority and do a deal with Israel, it would be unviable, untenable, and a disaster for the Palestinian people. So I suppose what I'm suggesting back to you, that one of the unique features of the Israel-Palestine thing is that there is no outside force playing a positive role, that the world's superpower is on the side of one side, and the others, the other powerful states, are running along behind them. And because Israel itself is a colonial anachronism, I mean, it's the kind of state that they were getting rid of after the Second World War, certainly not necessarily replaced with anything that was a great improvement, but it is an anachronism. There's no question about that. It's like we're living through the late 19th century with Israel, the way it behaves and everything. So I feel a campaign that almost declares by default a Palestine state in the international community. I'm sure that idea can be knocked down in many ways, but I think the Palestinians themselves might have something interesting to say about that. My concern would be that, such as the pressure on, for example, well, two things. First, Fatah has been so corrupted by the US. They've got this General Drayton in there and CIA pouring in something like $230 million to really organize a Fatah Palestinian army against their own people. My fear is that Hamas will be drawn into this kind of fake respectability. The irony of the demonizing of Hamas, of course, is that it's bent over backwards to do a deal with Israel, not only offering them a 10-year truce, but in effect offering them a kind of two-state agreement. What the Israelis, the Americans, and the press keep doing is reaching back to the old Hamas charter, which, yes, has the stuff in it, we don't want an Israel state and everything, but so much has changed since then. My concern would be that Hamas is, by the sheer pressure, is drawn into a Fatah-type situation. So something has to change before that, because if that happens, then the Palestinian people really are in difficulty in the future. So I suppose the answer to your question is that, yes, I do believe in a one state, but perhaps we can suggest it in another way.
Thank you, John.